This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Best of Me, written and read by David Sedaris, featuring an interview by Paul Constant.
From my brother, Paul. Introduction. I'm not the sort of person who goes around feeling good about himself. I have my days, don't get me wrong, but any confidence I possess, especially in regard to my writing, was planted and nurtured by someone else, first a teacher, then later an agent or editor. Hey, he or she would say, this is pretty good. Really? This was my cheap way of getting them to say it again. You're not just telling me that because you feel sorry for me? Yes, I mean, no, I really like it. Still, I never quite believed them. What lifted me up was writing for The New Yorker. While this had always been a fantasy of mine, I did nothing to nudge it along. I'd always heard that if the magazine wanted you, they'd find you. And that's exactly what happened. I started my relationship with them in 1995 when an editor phoned and asked if I might write a shouts and murmurs piece on then-President Bill Clinton's welfare reform proposal. I was given one day to complete it, and when I was told that it would run in the next week's issue, something inside me changed. It wasn't seismic, like an earthquake, but more like a medium-sized boulder that had shifted a little. Nevertheless, I felt it. When the magazine came out, I opened it to my piece, arranged it just so on the kitchen table, and strolled past it, wanting my younger, 20-year-old self to see his name at the top of the page. Wait a minute. Is that me in The New Yorker? 39 years it had taken the magazine to notice me. Good thing I wasn't in any rush. If you read an essay in Esquire and don't like it, there could be something wrong with the essay. If it's in The New Yorker, on the other hand, and you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. That said, you're never going to please everyone. It's hard to think of a single entry in this book that didn't generate a complaint of one sort or another. And it could be anything. How dare you suggest French dentists are better than American ones? What sort of monster won't swap seats on a plane? Many were angry that I'd inadvertently killed a couple of sea turtles. Granted, that was bad, but I was a child at the time. And don't you have to eventually forgive someone for what he did when he was 12? There is literally nothing you can print anymore that isn't going to generate a negative response. This, I believe, was brought on by the internet. It used to be that you'd write a letter of complaint, then read it over, wondering, is this really worth a 25-cent stamp? With the advent of email, complaining became free. Thus, people who were maybe a tiny bit offended could, at no cost whatsoever, let you know that they were never going to buy any of your books ever again. They always take the scorched earth policy for some reason. Of all the entries in this book, the one that generated the most anger was The Motherless Bear. Oh, the mail I got. How dare you torture animals like this? It's a fictional story, I wrote back to everyone who complained. The giveaway is that the title character speaks English and feels sorry for herself. Bears don't do that in real life. That wasn't enough for a woman in England. I urge you not to mock these intelligent and sentient creatures, she wrote, demanding that I atone by involving myself with the two bear rescue organizations she listed at the bottom of her letter. Just as we can never really tell what our own breath smells like, I will never know if I would like my writing. If I wasn't myself and someone sent me one of my essay collections, would I recommend it to friends? Would I stop reading after a dozen or so pages? There's so much that goes into a decision like that. How many times have I dismissed something just because a person I didn't approve of found it enjoyable? Or maybe I decided it was too popular. That's the sort of snobbery that kept my younger self slogging through books I honestly had no interest in. The sorts I'd announce had taken me 6 months to finish, but were only 200 pages long. If something is written in your native language and it's taking you half a year to get through it, unless you're being paid by the hour to read it, I'd say there's a problem. One thing that I would like about my writing is that so much of it has to do with family. It's something that's always interested me, and it's one of the reasons I so love Greeks. You could meet an American and wait for months before he begins a sentence with the words, "So then, my mother." It's the same in France and England. Oh, they might get around to it eventually, but it never feels imperative. With Greeks, though, it's usually only a matter of seconds before you hear about someone's brother or what a pain his sister is. There's a lot of talk lately about the family you choose. It's a phrase often used by people who were rejected by their parents or siblings and so formed a group of supportive kindred spirits. I think it's great they're part of a tight-knit circle, but I wouldn't call it a family. Essential to that word is that the people you're surrounded by were not chosen. They were assigned by fate, and now you must deal with them in one way or another until you die. For me, that hasn't been much of a problem. Even when I was a teenager, I wouldn't have traded my parents for anyone else's, and the same goes for my brother and sisters. It bothers me, then, when someone refers to my family as dysfunctional. That word is overused, at least in the United States, and more to the point, it's wrongly used. My father hoarding food inside my sister's vagina would be dysfunctional. His hoarding it beneath the bathroom sink, as he is wont to do, is at best quirky and at worst unsanitary. There's an Alan Gerganis quote I think of quite often. Without much accuracy, with strangely little love at all, your family will decide for you exactly who you are, and they'll keep nudging, coaxing, poking you until you've changed into that very simple shape. Is there a richer or more complex story than that? I like to think that the affection I have for my family is apparent. Well into our adulthoods, teetering on our dotage, most of us, we're still on good terms, we write one another, we talk, we take vacations together. I just can't see the dysfunction in that. The pieces in this book, both fiction and nonfiction, are the sort I hoped to produce back when I first started writing at the age of 20. I didn't know how to get from where I was then to where I am now, but who does? Like everyone else, I stumbled along, making mistakes while embarrassing myself and others. Sorry, everyone I've ever met. I'll always be inclined toward my most recent work, if only because I've had less time to turn on it. When I first started writing essays, they were about big dramatic events, the sort you relate when you meet someone new and are trying to explain to them what made you the person you are. As I get older, I find myself writing about smaller and smaller things. As an exercise, it's much more difficult, and thus, for me anyway, much more rewarding. I hope you feel the same. If not, I can probably expect to hear from you. Glenn's Homophobia Newsletter, Volume 3, Number 2, Dear Subscriber. First of all, I'd like to apologize for the lack of both the spring and summer issues of Glenn's Homophobia Newsletter. I understand that you subscribed with the promise that this was to be a quarterly publication. 4 seasons worth of news from the front lines of our constant battle against oppression. That was my plan. It's just that last spring and summer were so overwhelming that I, Glenn, just couldn't deal with it at all. I'm hoping you'll understand. Please accept as a consolation the fact that this issue is almost twice as long as the others. Keep in mind the fact that it isn't easy to work 40 hours a week and produce a quarterly publication. Also, while I'm at it, I'd like to mention that it would be wonderful if everyone who read Glenn's Homophobia Newsletter also subscribed to Glenn's Homophobia Newsletter. It seems that many of you are very generous when it comes to lending issues to your friends and family. That is all very well and good, as everyone should understand the passion with which we as a people are hated beyond belief. But at the same time, it costs to put out a newsletter, and every dollar helps. It costs to gather data, to Xerox and staple and mail, let alone the cost of my personal time and energies.
So if you don't mind, I'd rather you mention Glenn's homophobia newsletter to everyone you know, but tell them they'll have to subscribe for themselves if they want the whole story. Thank you for understanding. As I mentioned before, last spring and summer were very difficult for me. In late April, Steve Dolger and I broke up and went our separate ways. Steve Dolger, see Newsletters Volume 2, Numbers 1 through 4, and Volume 3, Number 1, turned out to be the most homophobic homosexual I've ever had the displeasure of knowing. He lives in constant fear, afraid to make any kind of mature emotional commitment, afraid of growing old and losing what's left of his hair, and afraid to file his state and federal income taxes, which he has not done since 1987. Someday, perhaps someday very soon, Steve Dolger's past will come back to haunt him, and we'll see how Steve and his little 17-year-old boyfriend feel when that happens. Steve was very devious and cold during our breakup. I felt the chill of him well through the spring and late months of summer. With deep feelings come deep consequences, and I, Glenn, spent the last two seasons of my life in what I can only describe as a waking coma. Blind to the world around me, deaf to the cries of suffering others, mutely unable to express the stirrings of my wildly shifting emotions. I just came out of it last Thursday. What has Glenn discovered? I have discovered that living blind to the world around you has its drawbacks, but strangely, it also has its rewards. While I was cut off from the joys of, say, good food and laughter, I was also blind to the overwhelming homophobia that is our everlasting cross to bear. I thought that for this edition of the newsletter, I might write something along the lines of a homophobia week in review, but this single week has been much too much for me. Rather, I will recount a single day. My day of victimization began at 7:15 a.m. when I held the telephone receiver to my ear and heard Drew Pearson's voice shouting, "Fag! Fag! Fag!" over and over again. It rings in my ears still. "Fag, I'll kick your ass good and hard the next time I see you. God damn you, fag!" You, reader, are probably asking yourself, who is this Drew Pearson, and why is he being so homophobic towards Glenn? It all began last Thursday. I stopped into Dave's Quick Stop on my way home from work and couldn't help but notice the cashier, a bulky, short-haired boy who had athletic scholarship written all over his broad, dullish face and Drew Pearson, I'm here to help, written on a name tag pinned to his massive chest. I took a handbasket and bought, I believe, a bag of charcoal briquettes and a quartered fryer. At the register, this Drew fellow rang up my items and said, "I bet you're going home to grill you some chicken." I admitted that that was indeed my plan. Drew struck me as being very perceptive and friendly. Most of the Quick Stop employees are homophobic, but something about Drew's manner led me to believe that he was different, sensitive, and open. That evening, sitting on my patio and staring into the glowing embers nestled in my tiny grill, I thought of Drew Pearson, and for the first time in months I felt something akin to a beacon of hope flashing through the darkness of my mind. I, Glenn, smiled. I returned to Dave's Quick Stop the next evening and bought some luncheon meat, a loaf of bread, potato chips, and a roll of toilet paper. At the cash register, Drew rang up my items and said, "I bet you're going on a picnic in the woods." The next evening, I had plans to eat dinner at the condominium of my sister and her homophobic husband, Vince Covington. See Newsletter Volume 1, Number 1. On the way to their home, I stopped at the Quick Stop where I bought a can of snuff. Now, I don't use snuff, wouldn't think of it. I only ordered snuff because it was one of the few items behind the counter and on a lower shelf. Drew, as an employee, is forced to wear an awkward garment, sort of a cross between a vest and a sandwich board. The terrible synthetic thing ties at the sides and falls practically to the middle of his thigh. I only ordered the snuff so that as he bent over to fetch it, I might get a more enlightened view of Drew's physique. Regular readers of this newsletter will understand what I'm talking about. Drew bent over and squatted on his heels, saying, "Which one, two bros? I used to like me some snuff. I bet you're going to go home and relax with some snuff, aren't you? The next evening, when I returned for more snuff, Drew explained that he was a freshman student at Carteret County Community College, where he majors in psychology. I was touched by his naivete. CCCC might as well print their diplomas on tar paper. One might take a course in diesel mechanics or pipe fitting, but under no circumstances should one study psychology at CCCC. That is where the certified universities recruit their studies for abnormal psychology. CCCC is where the missing links brood and stumble and swing from the outer branches of our educational system. Drew said that he was currently taking a course in dreams. The teacher demands that each student keep a dream notebook, but Drew, exhausted after work, sleeps, he said, like a gin-soaked log, and wakes remembering nothing. I told him that I've had some interesting dreams lately, because it's true, I have. Drew said, "Symbolic dreams! Dreams that you can turn around when you're awake and make sense of!" I said, "Yes, haunting dreams. Meaningful. Dense." He asked then, hunkered down before the snuff, if I would relate my dreams to him. I answered yes indeed, and he slapped the tin of snuff on the counter, saying, "On the house!" I returned home, my heart a bright balloon. Drew might be young, perhaps no older than, say, Steve Dolger's current boyfriend. He might not be able to hold his own during strenuous intellectual debate, but neither can most people. My buoyant spirit carried me home, where it was immediately deflated by the painful reminder that my evening meal was to consist of an ethnic lasagna, pathetically submitted earlier that day by Melinda Del Vecchio, a lingering temp haunting the secretarial pool over at the office in which I work. Melinda, stout, inquisitive, and bearded as a pot-bellied pig, has taken quite a shine to me. She is clearly and mistakenly in love with me and presents me several times a week with hideous dishes protected with foil. "Someone needs to fatten you up," she says, placing her eager hooves against my stomach. One would think that Melinda Del Vecchio's kindness might come as a relief to the grinding homophobia I encounter at my office. One might think that Melinda Del Vecchio is thoughtful and generous, until they pull back the gleaming foil under which lies her hateful concoction of overcooked pasta stuffed with the synthetic downy fluff used to fill plush toys and cheap cushions. Melinda Del Vecchio is no friend of mine, far from it. And regarding the heated lasagna steaming before me, I made a mental note to have her fired as soon as possible. That night, I dreamt that I was forced to leave my home and move underground into a dark subterranean chamber with low, muddy ceilings and no furniture. That was bad enough, but to make matters worse, I did not live alone, but had to share the place with a community of honest-to-God trolls. These were small trolls with full beards and pointy, curled shoes. The trolls were hideously and relentlessly merry. They called me by name, saying, "Glenn, so glad you could join us, and look, everyone, Glenn's here. Welcome aboard, friend." They were all so agreeable and satisfied with my company that I woke up sweating at 6 a.m. and could not return to sleep for fear of them. I showered twice and shaved my face, passing the time until 7, at which time my phone drew at his parents' home. He answered groggy and confused. I identified myself and paused while he went to fetch a pencil and tablet with which to record my story. Regular readers of Glenn's homophobia newsletter know that I, Glenn, honor truth and hold it above all other things. The truth, be it ugly or naked, does not frighten me. The meaner the truth, the harder I, Glenn, stare it down. However, on this occasion, I decided to make an exception. My dreaming of trolls means absolutely nothing. It's something that came to me in my sleep and is of no real importance. It is our waking dreams, our daydreams, that are illuminating. Regular readers of Glenn's homophobia newsletter know that I dream of the day when our people can walk the face of this earth free of the terrible homophobia that binds us. What are sleeping dreams but so much garbage? I can't bear to hear other people's dreams unless I myself am in them. I put all these ideas together in a manageable sort of way and told Drew Pearson that I dreamt I was walking through a forest of angry, vindictive trees.
Like those hateful trees in The Wizard of Oz? Those mean trees what threw the apples?
Yes, I said. Exactly.
Did any of them hit you?
A few.
Ouch! Then what?
I told him I came upon a clearing where I saw a single tree. Younger than the rest, but stocky. A husky, good-looking tree that spoke to me, saying, I bet you're tired of being hated, aren't you? I could hear Drew scratching away with his pencil and repeating my dictation.
I bet you're tired of being hated.
I told Drew that the tree had spoken in a voice exactly like his own, low and firm, yet open and friendly.
Like my voice, really?
He seemed pleased.
Damn, my voice on a tree. I never thought about a thing like that.
That night, I dreamt I was nailed to a cross that was decorated here and there with fragrant tulips. I glanced over at the cross next to me, expecting to see Christ, but instead, nailed there, I saw Don Rickles. We waved at each other and he mouthed the words, "Hang in there." I called Drew the next morning and told him that I once again dreamt I was in the forest clearing. Once again, I found myself face to face with the husky tree.
What'd the tree say this time?
I told him the tree said, "Let me out. Let me out. I'm yearning to break free."
Break free of what?
Chains and limitations, I said. The tree said, "Strip me of my bark. Strip me of my bark."
The tree said that to you personally, or was there someone else standing around?
I told him that the tree had spoken to me personally, and that I had no choice but to do as I was told. I peeled away the bark with my bare hands and out stepped Drew, naked and unashamed.
Naked in the woods? I was in the woods naked like that, then what?
I told Drew I couldn't quite remember what happened next. It was right on the tip of my mind where I couldn't quite grasp it.
Drew said, "I want to know what I was doing naked in the woods is what I want to know."
I said, "Well, are you naked now?"
"Now?"
Drew, apparently uncertain, took a moment before saying,
"No, I got my underwear on."
I suggested that if he put the telephone receiver into the pouch of his briefs, it might trigger something that would help me recall the rest of my dream. I heard the phone muffle. When I yelled, "Did you put the phone where I told you to?" I heard a tiny, far-off voice saying,
"Yeah, I sure did. It's down there now." "Jump up and down," I yelled. "Jump."
I heard shifting sounds as Drew's end of the telephone jounced around in his briefs. I heard him yell,
"Are you remembering yet?"
And then, in the distance, I heard a woman's voice screaming,
"Drew Pearson, what in the name of God are you doing with that telephone? Other people have to put their mouth on that thing too, you know. You should be strung up for doing a thing like that. God damn you!"
I heard Drew say that he was doing it in order to help someone remember a dream. Then I heard the words moron, shit for brains, and the inevitable fag, as in,
"Some fag put you up to this, didn't he? God damn you!"
Then Drew must have taken the receiver out of his briefs because suddenly I could hear him loud and clear, and what I heard was homophobia at its worst.
"Fag, God damn it, I'll kick your ass good and hard the next time I see you. God damn you to hell!"
The words still echo in my mind. I urge all of my readers to boycott Dave's Quick Stop. I urge you to phone Drew Pearson any time, day or night, and tell him you dreamt you were sitting on his face. Drew Pearson's home, a phobic, telephone number is 787-5008. Call him and raise your voice against homophobia. So that, in a nutshell, was my morning. I pulled myself together and subjected myself to the daily homophobia convention that passes as my job. Once there, I was scolded by my devious and homophobic department head for accidentally shredding some sort of a disputed contract. Later that afternoon, I was confronted once again by that casserole-wielding mastodon, Melinda Delvecchio, who grew tearful when informed that I would sooner dine on carpet remnants than another of her foil-covered ethnic slurs. On my way home from the office, I made the mistake of stopping at the food carnival, where I had no choice but to park in one of the so-called handicap spaces. Once inside the store, I had a tiff with the homophobic butcher over the dictionary definition of the word cutlet. I was completely ignored by the homophobic chimpanzee they've hired to run the produce department, and I don't even want to talk about the cashier. After collecting my groceries, I returned to the parking lot, where I encountered a homophobe in a wheelchair, relentlessly bashing my car again and again with the foot pedals of his little chariot. Regular readers of Glenn's homophobia newsletter know that I, Glenn, am not a violent man. Far from it. But in this case, I had no choice but to make an exception. My daily homophobia quota had been exceeded, and I, Glenn, struck back with brute physical force. Did it look good? No, it did not. But I urge you, reader, to understand. Understand my position as it is your own. Understand and subscribe. Subscribe.
Front Row Center with Thaddeus Bristol. Trite Christmas. Scottsfield's Young Hams offer the blandest of holiday fare. The approach of Christmas signifies three things: bad movies, unforgivable television, and even worse, theater. I'm talking bone-crushing theater, the type our ancient ancestors used to oppress their enemies before the invention of the stretching rack. We're talking torture on par with the Scottsfield Dinner Theater's 1994 revival of Come Blow Your Horn, a production that violated every tenet of the Human Rights Accord. To those of you who enjoy the comfort of a nice set of thumbscrews, allow me to recommend any of the crucifying holiday plays and pageants currently eliciting screams of mercy from within the confines of our local elementary and middle schools. I will, no doubt, be taken to task for criticizing the work of children, but as any pathologist will agree, if there's a cancer, it's best to treat it as early as possible. If you happen to stand over 4 feet tall, the agony awaiting you at Sacred Heart Elementary began the moment you took your seat. These were mean little chairs, corralled into a theater, haunted by the lingering stench of industrial-strength lasagna. My question is not why they chose to stage the production in a poorly disguised cafeteria, but why they chose to stage it at all. The story of the first Christmas is an overrated clunker of a holiday pageant, best left to those looking to cure their chronic insomnia. Although the program listed no director, the apathetic staging suggested the limp, partially paralyzed hand of Sister Mary Elizabeth Bronson, who should have been excommunicated after last season's disastrous Thanksgiving program. Here again, the first through third grade actors graced the stage with an enthusiasm most children reserve for a smallpox vaccination. One could hardly blame them for their lack of vitality, as the stingy, uninspired script consists not of springy dialogue, but rather of a deadening series of pronouncements. Mary to Joseph, "I am tired." Joseph to Mary, "We will rest here for the night." There's no fire, no give and take, and the audience soon grows weary of this passionless relationship. In the role of Mary, 6-year-old Shannon Burke just barely manages to pass herself off as a virgin. A cloying, preening stage presence, her performance seemed based on nothing but an annoying proclivity toward lifting her skirt and, on rare occasions, opening her eyes. As Joseph, second-grade student Douglas Trezeyer, needed to be reminded that although his character did not technically impregnate the Virgin Mother, he should behave as though he were capable of doing so. Thrown into the mix were a handful of inattentive shepherds and a trio of gift-bearing 7-year-olds who could have probably given the Three Stooges a run for their money. As for the lighting, Sacred Heart Elementary chose to rely on nothing more than the flash bulbs ignited by the obnoxious stage mothers and fathers who had created those zombies staggering back and forth across the linoleum-floored dining hall. Under certain circumstances, parental pride is understandable, but it has no place in the theater, where it tends to encourage a child to believe in a talent that more often than not simply fails to exist. In order for a pageant to work, it needs to appeal to everyone, regardless of their relationship to the actors on stage. This production found me on the side of the yawning cafeteria workers. Pointing to an oversized crate that served as a manger, one particularly insufficient wise man proclaimed, "A child is bored." Yes, well, so was this adult. Once again, the sadists at the Jane Snow Hernandez Middle School have taken up their burning pokers in an attempt to prod A Christmas Carol into some form of submission. I might have overlooked the shoddy production values and dry, leaden pacing, but these are sixth graders we're talking about, and they should have known better. There's really no point in adapting this Dickensian stinker unless you're capable of looking beyond the novel's dime store morality and getting to what little theatrical meat the story has to offer. The point is to eviscerate the gooey center, but here it's served up as the entree, and a foul pudding it is. Most of the blame goes to the director, 11-year-old Becky Michaels, who seems to have picked up her staging secrets from the school's crossing guard. She tends to clump her actors, moving them only in groups of five or more. A strong proponent of trendy, racially mixed casting, Michaels gives us a black Tiny Tim, leaving the audience to wonder, what? Is this kid supposed to be adopted? It's a distracting move, wrong-headed and pointless. The role was played by young Lamar Williams, who, if nothing else, managed to sustain a decent limp. The program notes that he recently lost his right foot to diabetes, but was that reason enough to cast him? As Tiny Tim, the boy spends his stage time essentially trawling for sympathy, stealing focus from even the brightly lit exit sign. Bob Cratchit, played here by the aptly named Benjamin Trite, seems to have picked up his Cockney accent from watching a few videotaped episodes of Hee-Haw, and Herschel Fleischman's Scrooge was almost as lame as Tiny Tim. The set was not without its charm, but Jody Lennon's abysmal costumes should hopefully mark the end of a short and unremarkable career. I was gagging from the smell of spray-painted sneakers, and if I see one more top hat made from an oatmeal canister, I swear I'm going to pull out a gun. The problem with both these shows stems partially from their maddening eagerness to please. With smiles stretched tight as bungee cords, these hopeless amateurs pranced and gambled across our local stages, hiding behind their youth and begging, practically demanding we forgive their egregious mistakes. The English language was chewed into a paste. Missed opportunities came and went, and the sets were changed so slowly you'd think the stagehands were encumbered by full body casts. While billing themselves as holiday entertainment, neither of these productions came close to capturing the true spirit of Christmas. This glaring irony seemed to escape the throngs of ticket holders who ate these undercooked turkeys right down to the bone. Here were audiences that chuckled at every technical snafu and applauded riotously each time a new character wandered out onto the stage. With the close of every curtain, they leapt to their feet in one ovation after another, leaving me wedged into my doll-sized chair and wondering, is it just them or am I missing something? Christmas means giving. For the first 12 years of our marriage, Beth and I happily set the neighborhood standard for comfort and luxury. It was an established fact that we were brighter and more successful, but the community seemed to accept our superiority without much complaint, and life flowed on the way it should. I used to own a hedge polisher, an electric shovel,
and 3 Rolex gas grills that stood side by side in the backyard. One was for chicken, one was for beef, and the third I had specially equipped to steam the Oriental pancakes we were always so fond of. When the holidays rolled around, I used to rent a moving van and drive into the city, snatching up every bright new extravagance that caught my eye. Our twin sons, Taylor and Weston, could always count on the latest electronic toy or piece of sporting equipment. Beth might receive a riding vacuum cleaner or a couple pair of fur-lined jeans, and those were just the stocking stuffers. There were disposable boats, ultra-suede basketballs, pewter knapsacks, and solar-powered card shufflers. I'd buy them shoes and clothes and buckets full of jewelry from the finest boutiques and department stores. Far be it from me to snoop around for a bargain or discount. I always paid top dollar, thinking that those foot-long price tags really meant something about Christmas. After opening our gifts, we'd sit down to a sumptuous banquet, feasting on every imaginable variety of meat and pudding. When one of us got full and felt uncomfortable, we'd stick a silver wand down our throats, throw up, and start eating all over again. In effect, we weren't much different than anyone else. Christmas was a season of bounty, and to the outside world, we were just about the most bountiful people anyone could think of. We thought we were happy. But that all changed one crisp Thanksgiving day, shortly after the Cottinghams arrived. If my memory serves me correctly, the Cottinghams were trouble from the very first moment they moved in next door. Doug, Nancy, and their unattractive 8-year-old daughter, Eileen, were exceedingly envious and greedy people. Their place was a little smaller than ours, but it made sense, seeing as there were 4 of us and only 3 of them. Still, though, something about the size of our house so bothered them that they hadn't even unpacked the first suitcase before starting construction on an indoor skating rink and a 3,000-square-foot pavilion where Doug could show off his collection of pre-Columbian sofa beds. Because we felt like doing so, Beth and I then began construction on an indoor soccer field and a 5,000-square-foot rotunda where I could display my collection of pre-Columbian sofa beds. Doug would tell all the neighbors I'd stolen the idea from him, but I'd been thinking about pre-Columbian sofa beds long before the Cottinghams pulled into town. They just had to cause trouble, no matter what the cost. When Beth and I built a 7-screen multiplex theater, they had to go and build themselves a 12-screener. This went on, and to make a long story short, within a year's time, neither of us had much of a yard. The 2 houses now butted right up against one another, and we blocked out the west side windows so we wouldn't have to look into their gaudy fitness center or second-story rifle range. Despite their competitive nature, Beth and I tried our best to be neighborly and occasionally invite them over for rooftop barbecues and so forth. I'd attempt to make adult conversation, saying something like, "I just paid $8,000 for a pair of sandals that don't fit me." Doug would counter, saying that he himself had just paid $10,000 for a single flip-flop he wouldn't wear even if it did fit him. He was always very combative that way. If it cost you $70,000 to have a cavity filled, you could bet your boots it cost him at least $125,000. I suffered his company for the better part of a year, until one November evening when we got into a spat over which family sent out the most meaningful Christmas card. Beth and I normally hired a noted photographer to snap a portrait of the entire family surrounded by the gifts we had received the year before. Inside the Christmas card would be the price of these gifts, along with the message, "Christmas means giving." The Cottinghams favored their card, which consisted of a Xeroxed copy of Doug and Nancy's stock portfolio. I said that while it is all very well and good to have money, their card said nothing about the way they spent money. Like our card said, Christmas means giving, and even if he were to gussy up his stock report with a couple of press-on candy canes, it would still fail to send the proper holiday message. The conversation grew quite heated, and some punches were thrown between the wives. We'd all had a few drinks, and by the time the Cottinghams left our house, it was generally assumed that our friendship was over. I dwelled upon the incident for a day or two, and then turned my attention towards the approaching holidays. We'd just finished another of our gut-busting Thanksgiving dinners, and Beth, the boys, and I were watching a bullfight on TV. We could watch whatever we wanted back then because we still had our satellite dish. Juan Carlos Ponce de Velasquez had just been gored something fierce, and we were all acting pretty excited about it when the doorbell rang. I figured one of the boys had ordered a pizza and opened the door, surprised to find a foul-smelling beggar. He was a thin, barefoot man with pepperoni-sized scabs on his legs and an unkempt beard smeared with several different varieties of jam. I sensed it was a jam we'd thrown into the garbage the night before, and one look at the overturned trash can told me that I was right. This had me pretty ticked off, but before I could say anything about it, the old bum pulled out a coffee mug and started whining for money. When Beth asked who was at the door, I called out, "Code Blue," which was our secret signal that one of us should release the hounds. We had two of them back then, big Dobermans named Butterscotch and Mr. Lewis. Beth tried to summon them from the dining room, but having gorged themselves on turkey and stuffing, it was all they could do to lift their heads and vomit. Seeing as they were laid up, I got down on my hands and knees and bit the guy myself. Maybe it was a bullfight, but for whatever reason, I had a sudden taste for blood. My teeth barely broke the skin, but that was all it took to send the old coot hobbling over to the Cottinghams' place. I watched him pound upon their door, knowing full well what would happen when he told competitive Doug Copycat that I'd given him one measly bite on the calf. Beth called me into the house for one reason or another, and when I returned to the door a few minutes later, I saw Helvetica, the Cottinghams' maid, taking a photograph of Doug, Nancy, and Eileen, handing the tramp a $1 bill. I knew something was up, and sure enough, 2 weeks later, I came to find that exact same snapshot on the Cottinghams' Christmas card, along with the words, "Christmas means giving." That had always been our slogan, and here he'd stolen it, twisting the message in an attempt to make us appear selfish. It had never been our way to give to others, but I started having second thoughts when I noticed the phenomenal response the Cottinghams received on the basis of their Christmas card. Suddenly, they were all anyone was talking about. Walk into any holiday party and you'd hear, "Did you see it? I think it's positively enchanting. Here these people donated money to an absolute stranger. Can you beat that? A whole dollar they gave to this vagrant person with absolutely nothing to his name. If you ask me, those Cottinghams are a couple of very brave and generous people." Doug would probably say that I unfairly stole his idea when I myself became a generous person, but that was not the case. I'd been thinking about being generous long before he showed up on the scene, and besides that, if he could illegally pinch my holiday slogan, why couldn't I casually borrow a concept that had been around for a good 10 years? When I first told people that I'd given $2 to the Inner City Headache Fund, they turned away as if they didn't believe me. Then I actually did give $2 to the Headache Fund, and boy, did things ever change once I started flashing around that canceled check. Generosity can actually make people feel quite uncomfortable if you talk about it enough. I don't mean the bad, boring uncomfortable, but something much richer. If practiced correctly, generosity can induce feelings of shame, inadequacy, and even envy, to name just a few. The most important thing is that you keep some written or visual proof of your donation. Otherwise, there's really no point in giving to charity. Doug Cottingham would say I took that line from him, but I'm pretty sure I read it in a tax manual. I carried my canceled check to all the important holiday parties, but people lost interest shortly after New Year's Eve. The seasons passed, and I forgot all about my generosity until the following Thanksgiving when the old tramp returned to our neighborhood. He must have remembered the previous year's bite to the leg, and as a result, he was just about to pass us by when we called him in for a good dose of benevolence. First, we videotaped him eating a palmful of leftover stuffing, and then I had Beth snap a picture as I handed the geezer a VCR. It was an old top-loading Betamax, but put a new cord on it and I'm pretty sure it would have worked just fine. We watched then as he strapped the machine onto his back and headed next door to continue his begging. The sight of that VCR was all it took for that skunk Doug Cottingham, who stepped into his house and returned to present the old codger with an 8-track tape deck, and oh, once again their maid was on hand to take a picture of it. We then called the tramp back over to our house and gave him a year-old blow dryer. The Cottinghams responded with a toaster oven. Within an hour, we had advanced to pool tables and stairmasters. Doug gave him a golf cart, and I gave him my satellite dish. This went on and on until any fool could see exactly where it was heading. Handing over the keys to his custom-built motorized travel sauna, Doug Cottingham gave me a look that seemed to say, "Top that, neighbor." Beth and I had seen that look before, and we hated it. I could have easily topped his travel sauna, but we were running low on film and thought it best to cut to the chase. Why needlessly escalate when we all knew what was most important? After a brief conference, Beth and I called the tramp back over and asked which he liked better, young boys or young girls. Much to our delight, he said that girls were too much of a headache, but that he'd had some fun with boys before his last visit to our local state penitentiary. That said, we gave him our 2 10-year-old sons, Taylor and Weston. Top that, neighbor. You should have seen the look on Doug Cottingham's face. That year's Christmas card was our most meaningful to date. It pictured our son's tearful goodbye along with the message, "Christmas means giving until it hurts." We were the toast of the neighborhood that holiday season, back on top where we belonged. Beth and I were the couple to have at any cocktail party or informal tree trimming. "Where are those super generous people with that delightful Christmas card?" someone would ask, and the host would point in our direction while the Cottinghams bitterly gritted their teeth. As a last-ditch effort to better their names, they donated their horse-faced daughter Eileen to a crew of needy pirates, but anyone in the know could see it as the desperate gesture it really was. Once again, we were the ones everyone wanted to be with, and the warm glow of their admiration carried us through the holiday season. We received a second helping of awe early the following summer when the boys were discovered dead in what used to be Doug Cottingham's motorized travel sauna. The neighbors all wanted to send flowers, but we said we'd prefer them to make a donation in our name to the National Sauna Advisory Board or the Sex Offenders Defense Fund. This was a good move, and soon we had established ourselves as Christ-like. The Cottinghams were, of course, furious, and immediately set to work on their tired game of one-upmanship. It was most likely the only thing they thought about, but we didn't lose any sleep over it. For that year's holiday cards, we had settled on the theme, "Christmas means giving until it bleeds." Shortly after Thanksgiving, Beth and I had visited our local blood bank, where we nearly drained our body's precious accounts. Pale and dizzy from our efforts, it was all we could do to lift a hand and wave to one another from our respective gurneys. We recovered in time and were just sealing our envelopes when the postman delivered our neighbor's holiday card, which read, "Christmas means giving of yourself." The cover pictured Doug lying outstretched upon an operating table as a team of surgeons busily, studiously removed his glistening Cottingham lung. Inside the card was a photograph of the organ's recipient, a haggard coal miner holding a sign that read, "Douglas Cottingham saved my life." How dare he? Beth and I had practically invented the theme of medical generosity, and it drove us mad, that smug, superior expression seeping from beneath our neighbor's surgical mask. Any long-married couple can, in times of crisis, communicate without speaking. This fact was illustrated as my wife and I wordlessly leapt into action. Throwing down her half-sealed envelope, Beth called the hospital while I contacted a photographer from our car phone. Arrangements were made, and before the night was over, I had donated both my eyes, a lung, one of my kidneys, and several important veins surrounding my heart. Having an unnatural attachment to her internal organs, Beth surrendered her scalp, her teeth, her right leg, and both breasts. It wasn't until after her surgery that we realized my wife's contributions were non-transferable, but by that time it was too late to sew them back on. She gave the scalp to a startled cancer patient, made a keepsake necklace of her teeth, and brought the leg and breasts to the animal shelter where they were hand-fed to a litter of starving border collies. That made the local evening news, and once again the Cottinghams were green with envy over our good fortune. Donating organs to humans was one thing, but the community went wild over what Beth had done for those poor abandoned puppies. At each and every holiday party, our hosts would beg my wife to shake their dog's hand or pass a blessing over the shell of their ailing tortoise. The coal mining recipient of Doug Cottingham's lung had died when his cigarette set fire to the sheets and bandages covering his chest, and now their name was practically worthless. We were at the Heppelwhites' Christmas Eve party when I overheard Beth whisper, "That Doug Cottingham couldn't even donate a decent lung." She laughed then, long and hard, and I placed my hand upon her shoulder, feeling the gentle bite of her keepsake necklace. I was, no doubt, drawing a good deal of attention myself, but this was Beth's night, and I gave it to her freely because I was such a generous person. We were a team, she and I, and while I couldn't see the way people were looking at us, I could feel it just as surely as I sensed the warmth cast off by the Heppelwhites' roaring fire. There would be other Christmases, but I think Beth and I both knew that this one was special. In a year's time, we would give away the house, our money, and what remained of our possessions. After scouting around for the right neighborhood, we would move into a village of cardboard boxes located beneath the Ragsdale cloverleaf. The Cottinghams, true to their nature, would move into a smaller box next door. The begging would go relatively well during the holiday season, but come winter, things would get hard, and we'd be visited by wave after wave of sorrow and disease. Beth would die after a long, sad struggle with tuberculosis, but not until after Doug Cottingham and his wife had been killed by pneumonia. I'd try not to let it bother me that they had died first, but in truth, I would have a very difficult time dealing with it. Whenever my jealousy would get the best of me, I would reflect back upon that perfect Christmas Eve at the Heppelwhites.
Shuddering beneath my blanket of damp newspapers, I try to recall the comforting sound of Beth's carefree laughter and picture her raw head thrown back in merriment, those bright, gleaming gums reflecting the light of a crystal chandelier. With luck, the memory of our love and generosity would lull me toward a profound and heavy sleep that would last until morning. The Incomplete Quad. I spent my high school years staring at the pine trees outside my classroom window and picturing myself on the campus of an Ivy League university, where my wealthy roommate, Colgate, would leave me notes reading, "Meet me on the quad at 5. I wasn't sure what a quad was, but I knew that I wanted one desperately. My college friends would own horses and monogram shoehorns. I'd spend weekends at my roommate's estate where his mother would say things like, "I've instructed Helvetica to prepare those little pancakes you're so fond of, but she's had a devil of a time locating fresh Cape gooseberries." This woman would have really big teeth that she'd reveal every time she threw back her head to laugh at one of my many witticisms. "You're an absolute caution," she'd bray. "Tell me you'll at least consider joining us this Christmas at Bridal Haven. It just wouldn't be the same without you." I fantasized with a nagging suspicion there was something missing, something I was forgetting. This something turned out to be grades. It was with profound disappointment I discovered it took more than a C average to attend Harvard. Average. That was the word that got to me. C and average. The two went hand in hand. I was sent instead to a state college in western North Carolina, where the low brick buildings were marked with plaques reading, "Erected 1974, and my roommate left notes accusing me of stealing his puka shell necklace or remedial English book. I expect someday to open the newspaper and discover the government had used that campus as part of a perverse experiment to study the effects of continuous, high-decibel Pink Floyd albums on the minds of students who could manufacture a bong out of any given object, but could not comprehend that it is simply not possible to drive a van to Europe. I spent my year buckling down and improving my grades in the hope that I might transfer somewhere, anywhere else. I eventually chose Kent State because people had been killed there. At least they hadn't died of boredom. That was saying something. Kent State, everyone said. Do you think you'll be safe up there? I arrived the following September and was assigned to a dormitory largely reserved for handicapped students. It had always been my habit to look away from someone in a wheelchair, but here I had no choice as they were everywhere. These were people my own age who had jumped into a deceptively shallow pool or underestimated the linebackers of the opposing team. They had driven drunk on prom night or slipped off their parents' roof while cleaning the gutters. One little mistake and they could never take it back. The paraplegics gathered in the lobby, perfecting their wheelies and discussing their customized cars while the quads purred by in their electric chariots, squinting against the lit cigarettes propped artfully between their lips. The first quarter, I roomed with a fellow named Todd, an amiable Dayton native whose only handicap was having red hair. The quadriplegics had the best drug connections, so we often found ourselves hanging out in their rooms. "The hookah's over on the shelf," they'd say, "right next to the rectal suppositories." Over time, I grew accustomed to the sight of a friend's colostomy bag and came to think of Kent State as something of an Ivy League university. The state would pay your board if you roomed with a handicapped student, so second quarter, I moved in with Dale, a 75-pound sophomore with muscular dystrophy. I learned to bathe Dale and set him on the toilet. I turned the pages of his books, dialed the telephone, and held the receiver against his mouth as he spoke. I dressed him and combed his hair, fed him and clipped his toenails, but I can't say that we were ever close. Midway through the term, Dale was sent back home to live with his parents, and I moved in with Peg, a fun girl with a degenerative nerve disease. Peg was labeled an incomplete quad and liked to joke that she couldn't finish anything. Already, we had something in common. She had come to school to escape her parents, who refused her any beverage after 6 p.m. They complained that at the end of a long day, they were simply too worn out to set her on the toilet. God had chosen her to suffer this disease, and if she had any complaints, she should take it up with him. This was a nasty illness that left its host progressively incapacitated. Peg's limbs were twisted and unreliable and had a mind of their own. A cup of scalding coffee, a lit cigarette, forks and steak knives, objects sprung from her hands with no prior notice. She wore thick glasses strapped to her head and soiled sheepskin booties on her useless, curled feet. Peg's voice was slurred to the point that information operators and pizza delivery services, thinking she was drunk, would hang up on her. Unnerved by the sight of her, Peg's professors automatically agreed with everything she had to say. "Good question," they'd shout. "That's very perceptive of you. Does anyone else have any thoughts on what she just said?" She might ask to use the bathroom, but because no one could understand her, it was always the same answer. "Good point, isn't it, class?" In the cafeteria, she was met with frantic congeniality. Rather than embarrass themselves trying to figure out her choice of an entree, they just went ahead and piled everything on her plate. A person in a wheelchair often feels invisible. Push a wheelchair, and you are invisible as well. Outside of the dorm, the only people to address us would speak as if we were deaf, kneeling beside the chair to shout, "Father Tony is having a guitar mass this Sunday. Would you like to join us?" Peg would beckon the speaker close and whisper, "I collect the teeth from live kittens and use them to make necklaces for Satan." "Well, sure you do," they'd say. "That's what our fellowship is all about." For Peg, being invisible was an old and tiresome story. To me, it definitely had some hidden potential. So began our life of crime. We started off in grocery stores. Peg had a sack on the back of her wheelchair, which I would fill with thick steaks and frozen lobster tails. There was no need to slink behind pyramids of canned goods, hiding from the manager. We did our stealing right out in the open. Peg carried a canvas bag on her lap and stuffed it with everything she could get her hands on. Canned olives, teriyaki sauce, plastic tubs of pudding. Our need had nothing to do with it. The point was to take from an unfair world. We quit going to the cafeteria, preferring to cook our meals in the dormitory kitchen, the butter dripping off our chins. We moved on to bookstores and record shops, guaranteed that no one would say, "I think I see that crippled girl stealing the new Joni Mitchell album." Circumstances prevented us from stealing anything larger than our heads, but anything else was ours for the taking. For spring break, we decided to visit my family in Raleigh. Being invisible has its merits when you're shoplifting, but tends to hold a person back while hitchhiking. We parked ourselves beside the interstate, Peg's thumb twitching at odd intervals. The 500-mile trip took us close to 3 days. It was our story that we were newly married and heading south to start a new life for ourselves. Churchy couples would pull over, apologizing that their car was too small to accommodate a wheelchair. They couldn't give us a ride, but would we accept $20 and a bucket of fried chicken? You bet we would. "There's a hospital in Durham we're hoping might do some good," I'd say, patting Peg on the shoulder. "Here we are, a couple of newlyweds, and then this had to happen." CB radios were activated and station wagons appeared. Waitresses in roadside restaurants would approach our table whispering, "Your bill has been taken care of," and pointing to some teary-eyed couple standing beside the cash register. We found it amusing and pictured these Samaritans notifying their pastor to boast, "We saw this crippled girl and her husband, and well, we didn't have much, but we did what we could." Someone would check us into a motel and give us cash for bus fare, making us promise to never hitchhike again. I'd take Peg out of her chair, lay her on the bed, and sprinkle the money down upon her. It was a pale imitation of a movie scene in which crafty con artists shower themselves with $100 bills. Our version involved smaller denominations and handfuls of change, but still, it made us feel alive. We were in West Virginia when one of the wheels fell off Peg's chair. It was dusk on a rural state highway without a building in sight when an elderly man in a pickup truck swooped in and carried us all the way to my parents' front door, a trip that was surely out of his way. 5406 North Hills Drive? I'm headed right that way, no trouble at all. Which state did you say that was in? We arrived unannounced, surprising the startled members of my family. I'd hoped my parents might feel relaxed in Peg's company, but when they reacted with nervous discomfort, I realized that this was even better. I wanted them to see that I had changed. Far from average, I had become responsible in ways they could never dream of. Peg was my charge, my toy, and I was the only one who knew how to turn her off and on. "Well," I said, wiping her mouth with the dinner napkin, "I think it's time for somebody's bath." My brother and sisters reacted as though I had brought home a sea lion. They invited their friends to stare from the deck as I laid Peg on a picnic blanket in the backyard. My father repaired the wheelchair, and when Peg thanked him, he left the dinner table and returned, handing her a second fork. "She didn't ask for a fork," I said. "She asked for your watch." "My watch?" he said. "The one I'm wearing?" He tapped his fingers against the face for a moment or two. "Well, golly, I guess if it means that much to her, sure she can have my watch." He handed it over. "And your belt," I said. "She'll need that too. Hurry up, man. The girl is crippled." My mother visited her hiding place and returned with a wad of cash for our bus fare back to Ohio. She called me into the kitchen and shoved the money into my hand, whispering, "I don't know what kind of a game you're playing, mister, but you ought to be ashamed of yourself." It was an actual whisper, designed to be heard only by me. The bus ride back to Ohio was long and cheerless. The second time Peg asked to use the bathroom, I snapped. "You just went 3 hours ago," I shouted. "Jesus, what's your problem? Do I have to take care of everything?" Got on my nerves, the way she depended on me. We'd gone on this trip, she'd had a good time, what more did she want? How was it that by the time we'd left my parents' house, I was considered the cripple, not her, but me. Me, who had to do everything while she just sat there, spilling ashes down the front of her shirt. My mood deteriorated. We returned to school where Peg related our adventures to a crowd of friends. I listened in, silently substituting every we